Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John.
And Kyle.
I'm a U.S. Marine, and the opinions expressed on the cast are my own, not official military policy.
And the opinions expressed by me are also my own, not those of my employer or any other businesses I happen to be associated with.
For today's episode, we're joined by special guest Brian Kroger, CEO of Rise 8. Brian, can you give us an intro?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I'm the founder and CEO of Rise 8. Prior to this, I spent 10 years active duty Air Force. First 7 years, I was an intelligence officer doing mostly targeting operations. And then I transferred to acquisitions, which no one ever does, left the coolest job for potentially the worst. And there I got the privilege of being one of the three government co-founders of Kessel Run.
Awesome. And I know we've talked about Kessel Run before on the cast, but could you give us just a quick background on why that was established and kind of what your role was in the beginning?
Yeah, absolutely. So the day that I arrived at Hanscom Air Force Base, I called DIUX. I had a friend who had just gotten stationed there under Lieutenant Colonel Enrique Odi. And I called them because I wanted their help transforming the targeting and geoint portfolio. So it was a program called Joint Targeting Toolbox. Most of my targeteers out there would be familiar with it. And he started me on what DIU had at that time was an OTA process, Other Transaction Authority, a faster way to do contracts and easier to work with commercial industry. And so we started this OTA process. While that was going on, he was actually running an experiment trying to build a planning application for the Air Operations Center. Some people know that story, but it was called Jigsaw, Tanker Planner Application, ended up being wildly successful. At about the time that they were demonstrating their success, we were ready to launch the contract. It was also the same time that the Air Operations Center 10.2 program got canceled, or rather defunded by Congress. And so AOC jumped on board, and together it was, you know, Colonel Odi at DIUX, the AOC program officer, who is Lieutenant Colonel Jeremiah Sanders, and myself from the Targeting and Geoint Program Office, co-founded Kessel Run and took that new way of working that the Jigsaw team had discovered and scaled it out to be what is now Kessel Run.
And when you did this, you were a uniform service member.
I was, yes. I was a captain, actually.
Yes. And
a junior one.
A junior captain taking on something fairly significant after a major acquisitions program was defunded. I would imagine that is somewhat stressful. And yet you've decided to continue to support DoD software in a civilian role. Can you talk us through a little bit, why stay with the DoD? There's a bunch of different options, a bunch of different people that are writing software. Why here? Why now?
Yeah, well, I mentioned I was a targeteer for 7 years. During that time, I saw, you know, I joined the military. I didn't do ROTC or academy. I came in after college, and it was a little bit new to me. When I found out I was going to be an intelligence officer, of course, I thought I was going to go be like Jason Bourne or something and have like the coolest technology, and I was going to have, you know, crazy.
Are you telling me that's not what intelligence officers do?
Yeah, no. A lot of PowerPoint. Death by PowerPoint, as targeteers like to say.
Does this also mean that cyber officers aren't like what I see at NCIS? You're crushing my soul right now.
But yeah, I mean, it's crazy, right? I mean, you certainly, obviously, I didn't think it was going to be that cool, but I thought, hey, we're going to have like the best technology. It's going to be really crazy. And I walked into my first SCIF and, you know, my computer barely worked. It took me like, you know, a couple hours to get logged into email. And you know, now that's famous with the Fix Our Computers memo that went viral from Michael Kanon. But, you know, it was shocking to me how we have amazing hardware. Don't get me wrong. Some of the best hardware on the planet. But inside all these operation centers, the software is just terrible. And really, the software on the assets that we have is really quite bad as well. So, you know, for me, it built up for quite some time over the course of 7 years. But my last assignment before I went to go do Kessel Run was at CENTCOM headquarters. Did a lot of counterterrorism work. And, you know, we're operating, doing counterterrorism drone strikes, right? Like you're operating at the very edges of machine speed. And we were back in the jock operating at human speed. And you just imagine like the mismatch there of trying to do things that computers should be doing at speeds that computers should be doing them. Where, you know, I was working out of an Excel spreadsheet macro, trying to calculate the moving ground speed of a target. And calculate, you know, weapons effects and collateral damage estimation. And so it was a defining moment for me. I came back from my first deployment shortly after that, the Kunduz hospital incident happened. And, you know, we struck at Doctors Without Borders outpost, killed international doctors, patients and family members. This is all public, right? You know, there's a public report out there on it, but software is just a footnote in that report. And it really frustrated me because when anything goes wrong in the military, we blame humans. We never blame the system, the management. And in this case, I thought that, gosh, you know, like if we had better software, I think a lot of these things wouldn't be happening. I can't say that for sure. There's nothing I can point to, but it's just this overwhelming feeling of like, of course these bad things are happening. We're using really terrible software to conduct extraordinarily advanced operations. And so that was what caused me to hang up my Intel badge and get myself reassigned to the targeting program office where they built that targeting software that I was using, or not using, when it worked, we'll say. And then, you know, from there, after doing Kessel Run, I served as the chief of operations there for 2 years, scaling it up to, you know, the 500 or so folks that were doing DevOps there. And I just felt like, man, I can keep going and scaling vertically, you know, go do the next Air Force program. But I really wanted to be able to scale horizontally and be able to help, you know, the Space Force, the Army, the Navy, other federal organizations that have really cool missions.
And one of the things we talked about as we were prepping to do this podcast was, hey, what's at the top of your mind, or what are you really driving toward right now? And you had said it was mainly a relentless focus towards war-winning software that warfighters actually love. Mm-hmm. In your estimation, what, like, help me do the task analysis here. What do we got to break that down to get that to happen?
Yeah. This was the original mission statement that we came up with at Kessel Run. Tied into that is really like the three core disciplines of product development. So you've got product management really being responsible for making software war winning, right? A true product manager should really understand product value and how it serves the business. And in our case, our business is war. So how do you enable the best outcomes in war? How do you, you know, what's the equivalent of profits on the battlefield? How do we achieve product value? Continuous delivery, obviously being an engineering discipline, really predicated on, you know, people read the Agile values. They always forget the principles. The first principle is that our highest priority is to satisfy our customers through early and continuous delivery of valuable software. So as I like to say, if delivery isn't continuous, then Agile has not manifested, right? So getting those engineering practices in place so that your code is always shippable, you know, without incurring quality issues or putting yourself at risk. And then finally, you know, warfighters love, that brings together the third practice of, you know, user-centered design and user experience. And so when we put together lean product management, we use extreme programming, but really any agile software development, and user-centered design, we find that we get the best outcomes. We get really short feedback loops working directly with users to find out how to solve their problems in the context of the mission that they're trying to achieve so that we can win the war.
And when you did, and I want to dive into all of these, but when you kind of did your first mental pass on this, did you think to yourself, this is going to be a really easy one-for-one corollary? I need to swap out this civilian term for this military term and it's already there? Or were you kind of like, ooh, this is, you know, square peg, round hole, I'm going to have to do some sanding?
You know, we tried to, I would say initially we tried to stick to industry terminology, and we found out really quickly that just didn't work. In fact, it wasn't too long after realizing that we decided to call Kessel Run a software factory, which has become a problematic term. It took on a life of its own. I wish we would have, you know, like really held on to it and defined it for the DoD rather than letting the DoD define it outside of our purview. But the idea there was, you know, we're producing software and shipping it to operations. And we were thinking along the lines of like Toyota. When you think of factory and lean manufacturing, Toyota is the one that always comes to mind. And in fact, there's this trail of thought from you know, Toyota to DevOps. It's like a really fascinating, you know, Gene Kim and some of the folks that he brings to DevOps Enterprise Summits have actually done talks on how Toyota basically produced DevOps. And there's this interesting thought chain to get there. But that was our original idea. Unfortunately, you know, it took on a life of its own, but we wanted it to sound like something that people that had a hardware mindset could associate with. And so similarly, things like, talking about warfighters loving software, I literally had a requirements manager stand up at Air Combat Command and tell me, we shouldn't care about whether they like whether or not they like the software. They just need to, salute and do their job. So
that person's got a bright future in the DoD.
Yeah.
Real bright future.
Yeah. I mean, Kyle, you're shaking your head and Brian's laughing. I have heard literally same concept said in slightly different words several times throughout my career. So yeah. I don't think this is an outlier that existed in a one-time off.
Oh, no. And please don't take my meaning the wrong way here. What I mean is we shouldn't expect battle-hardened warfighters to understand how proper UX principles should operate or that they should serve their customer, right? Like, it's a very... maybe being potentially politically incorrect here, but like it's a far cry from knowing how an infantryman serves their customer than a software developer serves their customer, right? Like one might be pulling a trigger, the other might be committing code and testing. And those are two very, very far ends of a spectrum.
Yes, yes. One thing I'll mention too, that might be really great for listeners is a lot of us enter our journey into this DevOps software delivery space through lean startup and like a very Eric Ries, version of, start small, scale fast, and build, measure, learn cycles. I think within that series, there's a lot of great books in the lean series. In fact, there's one that covers each of these three disciplines, but lean enterprise is the way that lean product manager should be thinking. Which takes a slightly different, more nuanced approach to what does it mean to produce value in an enterprise versus, if you're building a B2C software, like very different parameters for how a product manager operates in those two environments, how they have to think about the problems that they're solving. Because in B2C or direct to consumer, the user is the customer. But in the DoD, the user and the customer are actually slightly different, right? In the case of Kessel Run, AOC is the customer. We're trying to build business enterprise software essentially for the AOC, but we still have to satisfy the end users. And we have to do that in the context of another problem that I realized when we start using all of this industry language, it's very, I don't know if you can find anywhere in commercial industry where the shareholder, like the people that own the money and are funding you, the people building the product and the people using the product are all employees of the same company or organization, as it were, right? And so that creates really interesting dynamics too. So I do think that while there's a ton we can borrow from industry, we have to figure out how to adapt it to our own language and our own bureaucracy and the way that we're organized.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think that's something we will probably come back to a little bit later. But right now, I want to focus on one thing you said about continuous delivery. And we've talked about this on the cast a little bit, but we've never really dug down and given a kind of DoD definition. And I don't think we've told the listening audience why the military cares about this. Can you go into continuous delivery with a little bit more detail and kind of give an example that maybe the average listener who's not writing code on a regular basis would understand?
Yeah, yeah. So put very simply, this is a definition I'm going to paraphrase, but it's from Jez Humble, who literally wrote the book, Continuous Delivery. He says it's the ability to get changes of any kind into production safely, quickly, and sustainably. And that last part of the definition is really important because normally when we start talking about continuous delivery, people assume that we're going to cut corners, quality is going to go down, security is going to go down. That's not continuous delivery, at least not in a valuable sense. If anything, you might call that like continuous breakage. But yeah, the ability to get changes of any kind into production. And a note I said the ability to, which differentiates this from continuous deployment, which would be actually shipping it. So this means at any time my code is shippable, at any time I can ship it to the end user in their operating environment, whether that's a secret network in IUD to airbase cutter, like AOC was doing, or, some edge deployment for, special forces on the ground in some remote austere location.
Yeah. And I know immediately my head went to when you were saying, you know, continuous delivery and to keep writing and iterating and things like that. I immediately went to ATO and I'm thinking to myself, oh, yeah, this is going to trigger a bunch of paperwork. Have you encountered that at all? Or is this something that has completely missed you?
Yeah, no. So in the DoD, in order to deliver your software to the warfighter, you're going to need an authority to operate, governed by NIST RMF, the risk management framework. And the way that we implement that framework today in the DoD is really poor. But the framework itself isn't a problem, in my opinion. That's a controversial opinion. I also don't take issue with the NIST controls that are found in NIST 800-53, which are all of the things that you have to go implement in order to get an authority to operate. I think that most of the time, it's not that RMF sucks, it's that people suck at RMF. And if we could just focus on doing the hard things, which is not fun, it's hard work, it's tedious work, no developer certainly ever wants to do it. But when we were at Kessel Run, we decided like this is a problem we have to solve, or we're just going to keep facing it over and over again. And luckily, there were people that had come before us. But ultimately, what we ended up coming up with was continuous ATO. I'm actually the person that coined that term, and I apologize for it. We'll talk about it later, maybe. But the idea is, in order to continuously deploy, you need a continuous ATO. In order to get a continuous ATO, you need to perform continuous RMF. By calling it continuous ATO, people forgot about that last bit, which was in order to get a continuous ATO, you need to do continuous RMF. People thought it was a way to avoid having to do RMF or to cut corners or all kinds of bad practices that I've seen in the time since. But implemented properly, it means that we're doing all steps of the RMF process concurrently with the software development lifecycle so that when we're ready to ship our code from a business and technical perspective, there's no security reason or compliance reason why we wouldn't.
Okay, so I am guessing in the religious debate of CATO versus CRMF, you are generally falling, even though you coined CATO, you're generally falling under the CRMF camp?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I think the name is problematic. It also is made up, by the way. We were like really into marketing at Kessel Run. You know, we came up with logos and catchphrases and, did marketing and advertising on LinkedIn, which was kind of unheard of at the time. So it was a lot more catchy than saying CRMF for sure. It belies the real issue. But you can't find it anywhere in policy. I guess the DoD did publish a CATO memo now, which is like somewhat funny to me. But the actual provision that we used within NIST RMF, so if you're out there and you want to do continuous ATO, don't call it a continuous ATO because as soon as you do, it's now governed by this new policy memo and needs to get approved by DoD CIO. That's new policy, or guidance rather. It's in a memorandum that all new CATOs have to go through DoD CIO. But actually what we were implementing was ongoing authorization, which is an authorization type inside of RMF. It's been around for quite some time now, long before we were doing this. So ongoing authorization is what allows you to have an unexpiring ATO that is constantly renewed by way of, performing processes, continuous monitoring, et cetera.
And kind of a drill down on that question. So to be able to do that, to put the things that you need in place to be able to continuously work through the cycle, is this something you think that takes automation? Does it take engineering genius and excellence, or is maybe even something so genius and so unique antithesis to what you're trying to do? Have you put any thought into this?
Yeah. I mean, we've done several of them now. So, Kessel Run, now several software factories have them. At Rise 8, we've been involved in several. We even did the first one outside of DoD. So the boring truth of it is that it's not that difficult. It's not hard from a technical perspective. There is a lot of automation that you should implement, although just like Jez Humble says, you can do continuous integration with a old computer and a rubber chicken. You should look up that story, by the way. It's pretty great. This can be done lo-fi. You could do it in a spreadsheet if you really wanted to. But obviously, the more you automate, the quicker you can go, the less errors you're going to have, and probably the happier employees you're going to have. there are parts of it that can't be automated. And in those areas, we just employed a lot of process improvement. And then, you know, with that, there's also a relational aspect of this, of developing trust with your assessors. And we achieved that through transparency and what I would call unparalleled access. So we actually, first of all, we sent money to our authorizing official's office so that they could hire technical assessors who could actually come in and understand our code rather than just read, you know, like PDF reports about our body of evidence, you know, a la NIST RMF. And so they were still independent. They worked for the authorizing official, but we were able to get the talented ones that we needed. And then we gave them full access. They had access to our backlogs, our Git repositories, all of our pipelines, to the rule sets in our scanning tools. And now all of a sudden the AO and the SCA, the security controls assessor, they have more access to information in real time than they've ever had before. So that's just the first step, but like that step right there really establishes the trust and transparency. And I think most people are afraid to do that because of one of two reasons. One, they're not actually doing the work and people will find out. That's happening a lot. People are like, oh, we don't store our controls in EMAS. We store them in Git. And then you go look in their Git and they're not actually there. The other thing that we see, though, is people are afraid of weaponized transparency. And that's a real fear. But I would tell you, like, what's the alternative? Just like get it over with. And in fact, when we first started this, our SCA, or somebody in the SCA's office, I should say, took a bunch of information and started sharing it with people who didn't like Kessel Run, in an effort to get it shut down. And you just have to be able to combat those narratives, right? Like, did we ever have security vulnerabilities? Of course we did. Did we have pen tests that went poorly? Of course we did. The success story is that we were able to find them immediately and remediate them, you know, in almost every case within 24 hours, which is unheard of. And when I say remediate, I mean like we shipped a fix to the operations environment in that amount of time. And so just trust the process and trust in your ability to prove what you need to prove.
I want to talk for a second about that sort of weaponized information sharing, right? This is something that I see a lot of businesses, a lot of organizations struggle with internally, is how much information should we share? And our response as a business when I'm consulting with folks is like all of it, every single last bit of it. Because if you are sharing all the information, that means that you better have a good ownership of said information and an understanding and cognitive understanding of all that information. And it allows you to make defensible decisions about what you acted on and why. If no one has access to that intelligence, then it's very difficult for them to justify in their own minds a sense of empathy about what you did and why, right? I'm speaking in sort of general terms here, but if you are always hiding the information, you know, it's in my GitHub repo, even though it's not, kind of situation, it makes it tough for you to build empathy with others based on the decision-making that you do, right? Like, yes, we did a pen test. We found a vulnerability. We immediately remedied that vulnerability. We immediately reran the test and showed that it wasn't there anymore. And that is what progress looks like, everybody. And we did that in the course of 52 business hours. I don't know, right? Like, it shows some version of velocity as opposed to, yeah, we ran a pen test. No, you can't see the results. It's not a good way to build trust, right? We, from a third-party perspective, from an audit perspective, and I love the concept of bringing in auditors to look at your own code to say, show us where we're screwing up here, right? Or show us where we can be better. We have a learning culture and a blameless postmortem culture and all these things that kind of people buzzword about. But one of the best ways that I have seen to affect this inside your own organization is just share everything, massively over-communicate, right? Bury people with the data that you've captured and that you've been using to act upon. It's, you know, bold move, Cotton, I guess you could say, but at the same token, that's what good looks like. And it's an easy way for you to tell what good looks like elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say too, we didn't just stumble upon this at Kessel Run of our own accord. We stood on the shoulder of giants. Where I learned this lesson actually from was NGA. And actually, before NGA, I should say the people that really pioneered what became continuous ATO was 18F. And Jez Humble, who I mentioned before, was actually on the 18F team, which is pretty incredible to see the level of talent that we had on 18F at that time.
Brian, what is 18F, if I can ask real quick?
18F is a government organization. It's kind of in the vein of, you know, USDS, some of these like Presidential Innovation Fellows. It was a group that came in under the Technology Transformation Service in GSA. And they're focused on digital transformation at a broad level. They have a much more refined mission than that, but at a high level, that's what they were doing. And one thing that they stood up that I thought was really impressive, it was actually a Jez Humble talk where I first heard about it. It was called Integrating Continuous with Government. And it detailed how they built out Cloud Foundry, open source Cloud Foundry platform called cloud.gov. And they really took cloud inheritance, or sorry, controls inheritance. For those that aren't familiar, in RMF, there's a thing called common controls inheritance, where basically, if you're going to deploy on top of a cloud or, you know, some middleware on top of cloud platform, as it were, you can inherit the controls that they've already implemented. That's been around for a long time in RMF, but like people didn't really utilize it the way that they should have. 18F really took it to the extreme, built out Cloud Foundry, where you can inherit a massive number of controls as an application deploying there. And it really sped up your ATO process, but it still wasn't continuous. You still had to go through a formal application ATO process. NGA comes along and takes that concept. They use a commercial version of Cloud Foundry called Pivotal Cloud Foundry, which was much more structured and opinionated, so it satisfied even more security controls. And then they had what was called an ATO in a day event. It's worth noting, I don't know that they ever really got to ATO in a day, much like us. It was good marketing. But one thing that we saw, because a lot of people don't know this, but Kessel Run actually initially deployed to NGA's platform. We didn't have our own. So Tanker Planner and actually the first three applications after we formally started Kessel Run all deployed to NGA. And you would go to an ATO in a day event and present your package and hopefully get it approved. But inevitably, there would be like findings or confusion and it would get sent back and you'd have to wait for the next ATO in a day event, which for us, since we weren't internal to NGA, you know, sometimes we would get deprioritized and it turned into like ATO in 3 months or like, you know, ATO in 4 months. And it kept getting pushed back. And so I say that all, you know, like we couldn't have done it without them. And they were huge champions and great partners. But I actually interviewed, so applying user-centered design, which we talked about a minute ago, actually, we went and interviewed some of those assessors. And what we found, they kept saying was like, hey, a lot of times we're seeing these systems for the first time, especially these Kessel Run ones. We've had no involvement in the process. We don't know anything. Like, yes, it's our platform and our pipeline, so we at least understand that. But like, we don't understand your app. We don't understand some of the technologies you've implemented, and we don't have any insight on how you've implemented these controls. And so that lack of trust because of a lack of transparency and involvement became problematic. So that's why we chose from the outset to, and you know, this was like me and my team at Kessel Run taking that NGA model and saying, how can we improve this and make it continuous? So huge credit to them for really pioneering all that work. And I think there's an important lesson there too of applying user-centered design, not just to your product development, but to, you know, maybe we could call this a product, CATO, but like all of the services within your organization and the processes and who they serve, assessors are users too, AOs are users too. And like, how are we creating a great assessor experience was one of the prime things I was concerned about as I built automation for continuous ATO.
And a follow on there real quick. So I love the concept of essentially gearing that towards whoever's going to assess you, or, you know, in the Marine Corps world, we're very much enamored and obsessed with the AO, whoever approves all of our stuff. How did you go about soliciting feedback? How did you kind of do all the things that we would normally do, continuously iterate, et cetera? How'd you get access to those folks? And how did you frame that effort that you described?
Yeah. So, you know, continuous ATO, again, part process, part technology, and then there's like organizational psychology at play. So that's actually the hardest thing to build, as it were. But on the technology side, so, you know, there's obviously, we use what's called a secure release pipeline, where we centralize a lot of security-related tasks, quality-related tasks. You know, we get to the point where we're running scans on every commit, which is obviously better than running Fortify, you know, every time we deploy, which is probably like every other year. It is, you know, pretty typical to what we might see in DoD environments or ACAS scans that are running monthly or quarterly. Building out those pipelines and the rule sets for the scanning tools that the pipeline is triggering is something where we just brought in those technical assessors that we had the AO go hire, right? We used our program funds, hey, go hire technical assessors, and we built that for them. right? They were the user. So just like when I'm building Tanker Planner app, I call and interview Tanker Planners out in IUD Airbase. Like in this case, I'm going to interview the assessor, the security controls assessor, and find out what their pains are, what kind of things they want to see. And in some cases, you know, it's a little bit different because not all of it's custom. So it also helps us inform what commercial technology are we going to pull into our pipeline. Like one of the things that kept coming up was, hey, this NGA process is cool, but it's being done in Excel and it's hard to trace the actual controls and the implementation of those controls. That's when we brought in a product called SD Elements, where we could take the NIST controls, which it has out of the box by default as part of their regulation or their frameworks that they support. And it brings those controls to the forefront, right? We modified them so that all the ones that were being inherited from the platform wouldn't show up. And we can now inject those controls into the team's backlog so that while they're developing their code, they're like, oh, hey, you know, there's this control here for identity. How are we handling identity? Here's how we do it. Here's the architecture diagram for it. Done. Now there's a traceable identifier between that control, their backlog stories, and if it was a code level implementation, their actual Git repository. We decided to do that as a result of interviewing them and realizing like traceability was a huge pain point for them. And huge credit to, it was a lieutenant at the time, Lieutenant Wayne Starr and the DIUX team who found SD Elements, which became, I would say, a really critical piece of us being able to get over the hurdle of trust to get continuous ATO at Kessel Run.
Okay. I love that. You mentioned earlier that, you know, kind of like everybody wants a PDF as an output. Have you made any progress there? So I got that we've got, you know, you targeted the assessors and you got them to be clear with what their pain points are and you've got your traceability. They're getting the AOs comfortable. And then you're going through the process at a much faster interval. How are you able to move beyond everything ending up in a PDF and a PDF not being super actionable without a bunch of manual process on top of that?
Yeah, you need your AO to approve that. And I've done continuous ATOs where the AO still requires us to use EMAS because that's the DoD's system of record for controls. So, you know, AOs are able to accept risk, and one of the risks that they could accept, depending on how you read whether it's a policy or not, is potentially using an alternative to EMAS or maybe updating it less frequently in arrears, but not using that as the source of truth. So we've had kind of both of those examples. As far as PDFs then, you know, we get to the point, especially when we're not using EMAS, where the data is available in real time. Whether we're talking about scan results or actual, you know, controls matrix, you know, being able to identify how what controls were selected and how they were implemented and how they've been assessed. Because it doesn't mean necessarily that we've mitigated all risks, right? Some risks might be unmitigated and the AO accepts those, things like that. So but that's all stored in real time, right? SD Elements is a part of that picture in like a lot of the implementations we do. Git is as well. We've used ThreadFix in the past and other like aggregators for scan results and, you know, like having a commentable wiki for a POAM where your POAM is like a living, breathing wiki instead of a PDF, which is, by the way, is leads to better compliance and security because now if somebody says, I'm going to address this in 2 months, well, now I can, it's digitized. I can put a timer on that and I actually get a notification to check back on them. Or just automatically make them go non-compliant if they haven't satisfied that and they can't deploy to prod anymore.
And for the users at home, in case you're not keeping up with the acronyms, POAM, a plan of action and milestones. So just to reflect back to make sure I'm tracking what you're saying, essentially you get scans or you get a bunch of output from your RMF process and you essentially have a list of these are my problems and then you kind of lay out how you're going to achieve getting after them. Is that what you're talking about there?
Yes, that's the standard process for everybody, right? I think what's unique is, you know, at Kessel Run, and I believe most of the software factories, I'd be surprised if any of them aren't, you know, they don't allow critical or high findings. There was a point where we didn't allow mediums, which is pretty intense. And so, yeah, if you had, any findings above a medium, you just couldn't deploy to prod at all. And then everything else had to be mitigated within certain, you call it similar to a service level agreement, like, hey, mediums have to be addressed within 15 days. Or if something's found in the production environment, you know, like, hey, that needs to be mitigated within 72 hours or 24 hours, depending on the criticality.
Okay, so the last pillar that you talked about from the beginning, which I am most excited about because I haven't heard anybody talk about this, is the user experience. Talk to me about, especially in the military, talk to me about how you've evolved in your thinking and what you're kind of currently working towards.
And I'm so excited for this answer.
Yeah, so user experience is interesting. I kind of hinted at this earlier. It takes on a different meaning when you are operating in an enterprise environment and you're basically providing internal IT. So if you look at Kessel Run is an internal IT shop. They don't want to be labeled that way, but like that's what's really going on. They work for the Air Force and they're providing software for the Air Force. They're an acquisitions organization, so that obviously that gets complex and there's a lot of legalese, but if we just peel all of that back, they should be thought of essentially as the IT shop for the AOC. Now, of course, the AOC has a comm squadron and they're technically that shop, but you know, these software factories are also operating the software, which is what's unique. So as soon as you jump into that environment, it's important to recognize that first and foremost, I'm a firm believer. In fact, at Rise 8, we won't take projects anymore where we can't staff a UX designer. Like, I won't give you a product team without a UX designer. And the reason is because if we're going to operate with agility and we're going to abandon the requirements spreadsheet, I need a way to figure out how to get to the outcome that I've been given by a stakeholder. And the only way to do that, a product manager shouldn't be involved in that. They're thinking about business value, which I'll kind of talk about the differences between the two, is to have a user-centered designer who goes out and performs user research. So on the front end, if we're starting a new application, they might run a 4 to 6 week discovery and framing, which is kind of like a design sprint, to determine what are the biggest pain points, prioritize those pains, what are the possible solutions, right, going divergent and converging on, what's the first thing that we should build to solve these problems and create value for these users. And obviously that's super important. If you look at industry, there's some pretty interesting statistics. I believe it was either Microsoft or Amazon put out something on UX where they said for existing products, when they're developing new features, they get them wrong 66% of the time. We're talking about some of the best design organizations on the planet, and they get it wrong 66% of the time. So how often do you think we get it wrong when we're sitting in a working group, a requirements working group, or an architecture review board, and we're all in, you know, boardrooms, and nobody knows anything about software, nobody knows anything about product. We get it wrong all the time. And so I need somebody that can cut through that noise and figure out what's the next most valuable thing to deliver to the user. And then you use that to start your flywheel of, I create a great user experience. I use that user experience to create a great shareholder experience, right? I go to the Pentagon, I go to higher headquarters, and I say, hey, look what we did to these user for these users. I need more resources. And now I can create a better employee experience. And I can use that employee experience and the resources I have to create more great customer experiences. That's the flywheel you have to get going. Yep. It has to start with user experience. A lot of people try and start it these days with employee experience. They build these really cool software factories with like really cool desks and toys and everything. I don't advocate for that. I say hire the innovators, the people that can just like eat crap for the first 3-4 months, suffer through an awful employee experience because they care about the mission so much, and just focus on the user experience. So that's the flywheel. The actual practice is, you know, once you get through that initial design sprint, it's important to, you've defined what your MVP is going to be, but all along the way, you should be testing because you want to minimize the use of engineering resources. This is the other thing that the DoD needs to think about. It's like designers save you money. They save you from building the wrong thing for a long period of time.
And time, which is even more valuable than money.
Yes. So they're the ones that are going to tell you when you need to pivot. Like, hey, we're building the wrong thing. I tested these initial prototypes with users and like we're off base here. So instead of spending the next 6 months continuing to invest engineering resources in that, deploying it and finding out that the warfighter hates it, you figure that out along the way. And you can do that through really lo-fi means, like, you know, wireframes, to like really complex Figma prototypes, or even like, you know, I say this carefully, but like you could write a trash code like, hey, we know that we're going to scrap this. It's not like high quality code, but like it gets the idea. It's like a V1, a throwaway V1. There's a lot of different ways that you can buy down risk of building the wrong thing. And UX is a part of all of them. And then once you actually deploy it, user acceptance testing with your user-centered designers based on the criteria you set when you started about what user pains you're trying to solve and what metrics will tell you if you've solved them.
So, Brian, I want to double click on a couple of things that you just said there, because we've heard this a lot on the cast. I've heard this a ton in my day job. And just when we were at the Army Software Factory a couple of months ago, we heard people talking about this exact thing, which is this universal frustration with trying to build software that never sees the light of day. Like, I've had a team trying to build this new insert product here for 6 months and they haven't shipped any code yet. And there is such an insane value in over-investing in your initial UX and testing environment. Now, anyone who's listening to this cast right now and is ever thinking about building software, please hear me right now. I promise every single one of you right now can go find a low-code or no-code tool and build a product prototype in a weekend. And I mean that, a weekend with just pizza, beer, water, and a couple workouts sprinkled in there. Like, you too can have an ugly, terrible looking product that does some amalgamation of what you actually want to put in front of users. And I promise if you take that to a user on Monday morning, they will be brutally honest with you about whether or not it does what they want it to do. And by Monday afternoon, you will have far more actionable and useful data from which to invest in actually building some sort of thing you intend to put into production. Or, to exactly what Brian was just saying, I have seen people do this with sticky notes on a whiteboard. I have seen people do this with terribly drawn wireframes. That's what I do. And it works. Like, you can build this stuff in minutes to hours and show it to people and get feedback, right? Show it to the people who are going to use the tool. There's a great story that came out of the software factory about developing a piece of software that was in use by people who store munitions. I won't go into any more detail on this, but they basically said, yeah, we talked to them and they were like, hey, I can navigate stuff on my phone. Why can't you just do it that way? And they said, oh yeah, we can build a prototype for that, which they did in an afternoon, showed it to that same user like that day that they got the feedback. And the user was like, yes, that is exactly what I'm talking about. And boom, at least N equals one or greater that what you're doing is going down the right path. But I promise if they would have built it and that user would have said, no, you've totally misheard what I said. What I actually want it to do is this. That is the right time feedback loop for that information. It's not after you've had four or five sprints with an entire development team and a project manager to then show it to the person and have them go, no, that's not actually what I told you at all. So please over-index on talking to the end user of the software that you are developing and building the absolute lowest effort version of a prototype to show to them. So thank you for coming to my TED Talk. I'm going to get off my soapbox now, but I just can't stress enough how important that is and how much I agree with you.
I will do you one better. So I will take Kyle's plus one and I will give you the cheat code for the DoD. So you do everything Kyle just said. Then you say, hey, there was this lieutenant colonel outside of our org who said the way to do this is this, and you hand him Kyle's answer. You will get more feedback, more brutal, candid feedback than you have ever received when it is a field grade officer outside of your organization.
So wait, just for the record, what we're saying is I get to be the heel in this for everyone's use case. So I get to be Lieutenant Colonel Schmuckatelli is who I am here, who said to do it this way, and you'll get the feedback?
Oh yeah, you say, hey, Schmuckatelli says this is the way we're supposed to do this. If we don't give feedback by Friday, this is how we're doing it.
Oh yeah.
Boom. More feedback than you have ever received. If you say, Brian, I respect you and I'd really like your feedback, you are getting back a blank sheet of paper. I'm telling you, blame a field grade. Okay. There is nothing more powerful.
I'll add on to this. So when I worked at Google, the best way to get feedback was to overly publicly commit that you had a blatantly wrong answer to a problem. Like, post in a large chat room and say, like, the best way to migrate from database A to database B is to carve it in stone and ship it via FedEx. Like, and people will overwhelmingly go out of their way to prove that you are wrong, right? as opposed to, hey, can anyone give me feedback? It's just going to be crickets. Where as you say, you know, this is exactly how we're going to do it, and say something very wrong, you'll get tons of feedback.
Yeah.
I just gave you Pam from The Office. These are the same things.
I love it.
There's like some interesting traps that appear when you start trying to operate this way. So while I agree, like we over-index on you know, design tools and prototyping environments and that type of thing, you need to be able to get code into production immediately, like on demand. I've gotten to the point now where I say, like, okay, first of all these three things, right? Continuous delivery, award-winning, users love. The first thing that you have to achieve is continuous delivery. If you don't achieve continuous delivery first, you don't have the feedback loops that you need to do the other two. And so establish continuous delivery early. And once you have continuous delivery now, like one trap that came to mind as you were saying that is I was thinking of another thing that happens with lieutenant colonels and colonels and other folks who want to tell me, you know, hey, user doesn't know what they actually need. 18-year-old schmuck, like, I know better. I know how to run AOCs. This is what we need to build is... You can't have a debate with that person. And this is why requirements working groups fail and produce terrible software across the entire DoD. But if I have a continuous path to production, I can do one of two things. There's this great story. I think his name is Greg Linden. It's the Amazon shopping cart example where he went to his senior supervisor and said, like, hey, I've got this great idea. When people put things in the cart, we should tell them other people put these similar items in their cart. Or other similar people put these items in their cart. And he was like, no, that's going to creep people out because back then you weren't used to like people listening to everything you did. And so he shot it down. Greg ships it to prod anyways, comes back with all the data saying like, hey, it turns out it worked. We made a crap load of money. And, you know, he ended up being quite the hero for it. But like that type of environment is really important.
Yeah. Will not work in every company culture, for the record.
Yes, for the record, won't. But once you ship things to warfighters and they're proven to work, it is very hard for anybody, even a general officer, to roll that back. And so I would just say the more that you can ship to prod early and often, even if it is a prototype that's in their operating environment using real operational data at the right classification levels, that's going to give you higher fidelity than oh, cute prototype, but that won't work in ops. Like, no, I actually shipped it to ops and it's already there and it works. Or the other thing that happens is you can't win the debate. And so you just ship what the general or the colonel says, and then you show them the data on how it's not being used or that users didn't like it. And now you can end all debates. There's just no debates anymore. It's just like prod is the final arbiter of truth.
So, Brian, I want to ask one question to you here, because I tend to find this impacts a lot of the things that I touch today. And the team that I run is very much encouraged to do exactly what you said. Like, go put it in place. And the overwhelming feedback that I give them is I say, do not ask for permission, right? Mm-hmm. Dare someone to stop you, right? First person to write down the procedure or the policy doc generally wins. Because it takes a lot of effort to come in and correct someone's documentation, right? Unless it's blatantly wrong, like the example we just talked about. But if you just ship the information, don't ask to ship it. If you've got a good continuous integration, continuous deployment process where it's easy for you to ship code to prod or to your dev environment, whatever you want to talk about, just do it. Get to the data. Be data-driven in how you inform the people around you in decision-making. It's a lot easier as a senior leader to be told, hey, we want to ship a new product. Or I'm sorry, let me pull this back. It is much more difficult to say, I want to ship a new product. Can I get permission, please? Than to say, we shipped this into dev. We talked to six people. There was overwhelmingly positive feedback and everyone wants to use it immediately. Like, what leader is going to tell you no to that at that point where you've already done the work, captured the data and made it an easy win for them? Like, manage up with your software deployments maybe is a good way to
say. Yeah, yeah. It's worth saying, you know, in all my time at Kessel Run and even standing up Kessel Run, I never asked for permission and I never had it. Like one crazy story is I had the dollar value that I was seeking. I had to get my acquisition strategy approved by the PEO, like a 2-star equivalent. They denied my acquisition strategy three times. And so I just lowered the dollar value, got the new lieutenant colonel that had just arrived on station to sign it because he was now the signatory. And that was what led to the funding drop that became, you know, went to DIUX and became Kessel Run. So that's like one funny version of the story. It gets better because like a year later when they were doing the new like Section 804, Section 806 NDAA language, Kessel Run was chosen to be one of the pilots. And we recycled the acquisition strategy that got denied three times, and it became the like official Kessel Run acquisition strategy. So, you know, eventually your time will come. But one other trap that I want to cover related to user-centered design in particular, super important, is user-driven design. User-driven design is a huge trap I see organizations fall into, where instead of finding out what the user's pains are and then being a designer and designing solutions for that, they ask the user for solutions, or they allow the user to dictate solutions to them and they just go build them. You're not just a code monkey there to build whatever the operator tells you. It turns out that all of us, even when we're experts in our field, are really bad at designing solutions to our problems. If we were good at it, we would have already done it, right? Designers are professionals. They know how to interview. They know how to ask the right questions. They know how to design things in ways that eliminate pains that you probably never thought of. You know, it goes back to the famous thing that Henry Ford never said, which was, if I asked people what they wanted, they would have built, they would have asked for faster horses, right? Instead, we need a car. So that's a big trap. And the other one I'll just mention quickly is that is a discipline. Like, becoming a UX person is a profession. You can't just take a random airman or soldier, sailor, marine off the street and turn them into a UX designer overnight. And I've seen that we're sending people to boot camps to learn how to code, but then we're just sending them into these software factories, UX people and PMs without any fundamental training, and just like, oh, well, they can do UX. Like, that's not technical. They can go become a PM. They know their domain, and nothing could be further from the truth. Not only is it hard to become UX, it's even harder to become a product manager. And I think of all the three things we've talked about, product management is actually the weakest discipline across all of the software factories. And it's the reason why they're struggling. They're going to blame the bureaucracy, but look, the bureaucracy was hitting the crap out of us at Kessel Run. We were able to plow through that because we had good product management. And I think the less we focus on that, the more problems that we have. And what I see, unfortunately, is a lot of product managers, because they don't know how to manage a product, they just become a second user-centered designer. And there's no balance between what the business needs and what the user needs. And that trade-off is really important. You have to find that overlap. It's not always as neat. Like, there are things the user wants that don't matter to the mission, unfortunately. And so you've got to be able to suss that out.
Yep. I want to acknowledge, thank you for doing the Henry Ford quote that is not a Henry Ford quote. It's one of my favorite anecdotes that I use when we're talking about this. I had a conversation this morning, like just this morning, with a customer talking about UX and user research, and how they were like, we have an engineer that can do that. And I'm like, are they trained on how to do UX design or user research? No. And they were like, no, but they're good at writing code. And I had to have like a very long conversation with them about how this is a profession. Like, this is a thing that you have to get really good at and be trained in what good looks like. And that large companies get this wrong. And if you're just going to tell somebody, hey, you speak Spanish, right? I need you to speak, Italian by next week, you're going to get exactly the results that you should expect from that. It's not something that you can just swing into on a weekend. It's something that you need to find somebody who's very good at it. I have had the privilege of working with a small handful of UX designers who are truly gifted. And let me tell you, you talk about like 10X engineers, they are 100X designers, because they laser you in on exactly what needs to happen to make for a consistent and wonderful customer experience, right? Like, the most critical person in your entire product development phase will likely be your UX designer, which is shocking, right? Like, and things that ChatGPT and Bard and generative AI have not solved yet is how to do this. So just pay attention to those humans. They are amazing.
All right, Brian, I have a really bad question for you, but I think you'll be able to track with me and kind of fix the problems. So we talked about users a bunch, and using your AOC example, who is the user there? Is it the general officer who's approving the ATO? Is it the individual airman, soldier, marine, whatever, who's entering sorties and other associated information in there? Is it one of the field grades who's running the processes that get that stuff in front of the GO? And then it's almost like there's a completely second to whatever that answer is, there's another user that is the person who's accepting this thing that you've written on behalf of the government, i.e. probably approves the funding stream. How do you keep from splitting who the user is out a million times, or how have you solved that problem?
Yeah. This goes back to something I started with, which is distinguishing between user and customer, and then shareholder. The people that are managing the money, those are the shareholders. So I don't consider them the customer. The customer for Air Operations Center would be either you could think of the AOC as a like entity, not the commander, but like AOC as an entity as the customer, or really in our case, all the AOCs roll up to Air Combat Command. So I would say Air Combat Command is our customer. And we were providing them AOC, I'm going to call it business software, like mission software, right? And so similar to like B2B SaaS, when you're like Salesforce or anything like that, everybody that touches Salesforce is a user. So all of the above, the AOC commander is a user, the div chiefs are users, the team chiefs are users, and then everybody on each individual team is a user. The Army liaisons are users, our Navy liaisons, all of them.
Okay, so you think it more is a holistic user experience, all encompassing like that?
Yeah, so when you're building enterprise software, you have a lot of users. I mean, that's like one of the fundamental problems and why I said, you know, like the lean startup methodology is really great. I mean, I still think there's principles in there and values in there that are carry through, but the actual tactics are very different. We're building a lean enterprise. And so we need to think about how enterprise users differ and how enterprise business or mission use cases differ, and what value means to that type of customer. So you're going to have each of those personas. Now, keep in mind, Kessel Run, you know, at one time when I left, we were at about 22 individual application teams. So one of those applications, like Tanker Planner, the only users of Tanker Planner are the Tanker Planners. And like maybe you could say the people that end up consuming the Tanker Plan. So like the overall Master Air Attack Planners.
Okay.
Those are the users.
Okay, that makes sense. And then final question I want to leave you with, because I would be really mad if I didn't ask you this. So Kyle and I and several others who have come on the cast have advocated kind of like a threefold model for who writes the code, or a blend of each, of where we have uniform developers, military civilians, and contractors. What is your take on that, or have you put any thought into that?
Tons of thought. Enrique and I, Colonel Odie, one of my co-founders at Kessel Run, we were adamant about creating airmen coders. I mean, we went all over the place. We got new career fields created. We're all about it. I think that's absolutely the right long term. In the short term, it drove us to do some really terrible things that hurt Kessel Run. I would say the AOC, the product that we were developing, one of which was we were bringing airmen in TDY on 6-month TDYs, which is not nearly long enough to even create a competent, product person. But it also harmed the products. Army Software Factory is doing better by creating these 3-year rotations, lesson learned from Kessel Run. They increased the rotations. I think what we're still seeing, in my opinion, in that and some others where I've seen longer term uniform members, is that how long does it take to build a senior software engineer, right? A senior software engineer is usually anywhere between 6 to 10 years of experience. Now, through things like pair programming, like I'm a firm believer, I can build 10 years of experience in 5 years, but I can't do it in one, I can't do it in three. So even when the first cohort of like Army Software Factory completes, you might have a couple rare individuals that became senior software developers in that amount of time. They probably had experience coming in, but if they had no experience coming in, you don't have a senior software developer. So what are you going to do? Because your products need senior software developers, and they need senior UX people and senior product managers. And we don't even have good pipelines for those anywhere that I've seen. So with that, I think we need to supplement with civilian workforce and contractors. And if we want to build, my idea originally with Colonel Odie was we're going to have a whole wing of software developers in the Air Force, right? To get there is like a 10-year journey. And in the meantime, where we should be placing contractors is almost the opposite of what I see, because we do like lowest price technically acceptable contracts, and we look at rates and we're like, oh, $170 for a software developer, I can get them from this company for $130. And we think of them in dollars per hour instead of like their actual skills and productivity.
This kills me working in professional services all day too. It's just the absolutely backwards thinking.
Yeah. So we're bringing in contractors. We should be bringing them in to be senior software developers. We're paying the rates of juniors. So we're getting juniors, even though they give us resumes and tell us that they're seniors, they're not great. And so we really need to see these software factories investing in like, hey, you should be paying $200 an hour for senior software developers. And that's where you should be focusing your contracts. I might even go higher than that, right? If they're doing paired enablement, like you see at Army Software Factory, finding people that are good at that and like have the technical skills and the pairing skills to upskill you, those people should be like $250, $300 an hour. When we get into platform engineering, $350 an hour. But we're paying such low rates, we're just pairing juniors with juniors and we're not upskilling our people. So, you know, we say like, oh, through pairing, we're going to upskill them, but they're paired with people that are pretty much mediocre at best. So I think the strategy really needs to be thought through. We need to be figuring out like, all right, I need to bring in seniors and staffs and principal engineers via contracts. And that's going to cost me a lot of money. I have to plan for that. And then, you know, filling in those mid ranges with civilians until we get the pipeline of uniformed military members going.
All right, Brian, so we are at time and I'm going to kick it over to Kyle in a second here. But did you want to plug anything or get any personal projects out there?
The one I'll mention is a community thing. I don't want to shamelessly plug other stuff, but we have a conference coming up in DC, November 6, 7, and 8. It's called Prodacity. We really gear it towards a government audience. This year we made a government attendance free as long as you book at the hotel venue, just because we have to meet our attendance quota there. But if you do that, you can come for free. And last year we kind of set a baseline for how do you do DevOps in the federal government. It was 2 days of amazing content. We had Gene Kim there. We had Admiral John Richardson and a whole bunch of industry, just like people that blow your mind. You can catch the videos on our website at rise8.us/events/Prodacity. You can also register there. This year we added another day of content and we broke it out into three tracks. So we're going to have a product track, a procurement track, and a leadership track. So definitely would love all of your listeners, especially government ones, but industry is welcome too, to come. And our aim is to provide value. I don't make any money on this conference. I lose quite a bit. It's a labor of love. I just want to get folks the information that they need so that they can create change in their organizations.
Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on. And I will put both of those into the show notes. Kyle, it is that time. Hit us with your hot take.
All right, I'm gonna do a pre-hot take here because I want to applaud Rise 8 for a quick second because this is the first company that I have seen that has a SkillBridge intern listed on their jobs board. And for those of you that don't know what the SkillBridge program is, it is a super incredibly awesome mega dope program that takes uniformed service members pre-transition out of the military and lands them in jobs to get on-the-job training while their salary is still being paid by the U.S. government. It is a really, really cool program that I've been trying to convince many, many, many companies that I interact with to support. So I just want to say, Brian, thank you so much for having that on your webpage. Real quick, you can go to rise8.us/careers and you can look at everything that Brian's hiring for right now. He doesn't have to plug it. I'll do it for you. I'm not the one being paid by Uncle Sam. This is awesome and this is a cool company. I will leave with this. Go to rise8.us, that's RISE, the number 8.us, and go read the origin story of Rise 8. It is a super cool story that kind of summarizes in a lot of ways the things that Brian talked about here today. And I want to just make sure that message gets out there so we can help more parts of the DoD do proper software development, or at least better software development than potentially they may be doing today. And my hot take today, I'm just going to double click on what I said earlier. Do the minimum possible amount of effort possible in your product or in your software development to get feedback from the people who will actually use the software, right? Like, get the feedback. And don't fall into the trap, like Brian said, of having them tell you they want the faster horse, even though that's, again, is not how it went. But take what you know to be a massive improvement in their workflow and show it to them fast, quick, and in a hurry, and get the feedback so that you can go through a couple cycles of that so that all of your work matters. There is nothing that will just demoralize and upset you as a software developer than writing code that no one will use. Like, we all want to do useful things and like build products that people use and love. And that's how you do it. So all the love in the world to UX people and the folks that are fighting that good fight and doing the user research and doing the market analysis and all that stuff. Trust them. They're really good at it.
Dear listeners, thanks for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter and following at @USMC_TFPHOENIX. That's @USMC_TaskForcePhoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Jake Osborne. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving us a 5-star review and accompanying comment. And with that, we are out.